Hello and welcome to another episode of History Lesson Part 2, the show about movies, about history, and sometimes about the history of movies. I'm Jackson McDonald.
I'm Tyler Shipley.
And the movie we will be discussing today is Shaka King's Judas and the Black Messiah. It was released in 2021. Starring Daniel Kaluuya as Fred Hampton, the former chairman of the Illinois Black Panther Party, and Lakeith Stanfield as William O'Neill, the FBI informant who eventually contributed to his assassination. Spoiler alert. Although I don't think you can really do spoilers for movies that are about shit that actually happened. although I have seen that. Like, I was just before we started, I was watching a, I was just kind of trying to get in the headspace. So I just like YouTubed Judas and the Black Messiah. And there was like a Watch Mojo video that was like, here are the top 10 things that they got right historically and the top 10 things they got wrong historically or whatever. And I'm like watching it or whatever. And it's just like briefly explaining itself. And then it just immediately goes from that to spoilers abound in the thing. And I was just like, well,
yeah, no shit.
It actually happened, you know, like, I mean, not all of it, I guess, like,
yeah.
But I mean, the historical accuracy is something that we can get into in a sec. But I guess we should probably start with the actual historical context of the movie and Fred Hampton and the Black Panthers, which is, I think, something that a lot of people think they know about or think they understand.
Yeah.
But I know for myself, until I did kind of some more digging into the Panthers over the past few years, I definitely had a wrong-headed idea of what they were, even if I was more sympathetic than I think a lot of mainstream sort of political observers are.
Yeah, I mean, most people tend to, the thing people most commonly forget is that they were an anti-capitalist revolutionary party that had class struggle at the center of their analysis, and that was linked up with, you know, other movements that were revolutionary communist movements around the world doing class struggle, and that gets forgotten, and in most people's memory, even like as you say, even relatively sympathetic people tend to remember them as black nationalists, as, you know, willing to use violence and self-defense.
But they sort of conflate them with like the Nation of Islam almost. I find that because the Nation of Islam were another like black radical group of the same time, another group that in a lot of ways, yeah, like I once again, I'm largely sympathetic to a group that had a lot of salient observations and did some good things. And obviously Malcolm X is like one of the most important sort of political figures of the 20th century, but their ideologies were very different from one another. And I think it is, it's actually completely inaccurate to describe the Black Panthers as a black nationalist movement. They're not a black nationalist movement at all. They were, I would say a small portion of what they were was a black identity movement or a black, that's not even really quite the right term. Would I say like a black freedom movement almost, you know what I mean? Like they were advocating for the self-determination of black people.
Yes.
But not, you know, not like in a Marcus Garvey way where they should all return to Africa or create their own like black nationalist state. Or even, and I mean, this idea is like fraught because I think it was never really about this, even in some of the more extreme black nationalist groups. But like, none of this was ever meant to necessarily come at the expense of anyone else, right? Like, it's not a, and once again, like, this is a very fraught term that I think gets overused, but like, it was not a black power or black supremacist like movement. It was a Marxist movement focused on the self-determination of black people, basically.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the Black Panthers recognized fully, you know, the role that black people held in American capitalism, you know, was one of subservience, was one of segregation, was one of exploitation, and that was like specifically about race. It wasn't like they denied, you know, the racial character of American capitalism, but it was like they understood that the enemy was that racial capitalism, not white people per se. It was the system.
Yeah.
And which is why, and I think this is something they actually did a decent job of in the film. You know, it's why the Black Panthers actually formed coalitions with a range of different left organizations. They worked with Puerto Ricans, they worked with white people, they worked with working class movements across the United States.
Yeah, the what were they called? The Young Lords,
yeah,
and the Young Patriots,
yeah,
I believe.
Yeah, exactly.
And both of those organizations were real. The Crowns that are portrayed as well were, I think, sort of a composite mm-hmm. of a couple of politically active gangs in Chicago, but the Young Nationals and the Young Lords were two real groups that were similarly like identity focused kind of revolutionary groups for basically what you would pejoratively call like white trash.
Yeah.
And Puerto Ricans.
Yeah. And I mean, that's what,
and yeah, the original Rainbow Coalition.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's a bit of a corny name, but it's, I mean, it's funny to think that something as what we might now look back at, you know, and kind of corny idea of the Rainbow Coalition, that it came sure. out of the Black Panthers, because we tend to associate, and I think we've been taught to think that the Black Panthers were a black power, black militant group that was black nationalist and focused on violence, self-defense/violence, like depending on the portrayal, yeah. whether it's a sympathetic portrayal, you know, you might get, okay, well, they were focused on self-defense. And if it's a critical portrayal, then it's like, oh, they were violent. But it's always about...
Yeah, they were trying to do violence to, like almost like SDS or something, yeah. or the Weathermen, like...
Yeah.
Interested in doing this sort of adventurous, like, terrorism or whatever.
Exactly.
Which is totally, like, the opposite of what they were interested in doing.
Yeah, it's what makes the Black Panthers still one of the most important, I would argue, one of the most important left organizations in American history, because they actually...
And I think we could say also... Sorry to keep interjecting, but I will also just add, I think also we can both agree, also the coolest.
Oh, definitely.
yeah. Like, I mean, man, we were talking, you know, we talked in the first episode about the Cuban Revolution being led by Chads. This is another example of like, you know, like communists have often had pretty good uniforms and had a pretty good look. But the Black Panthers, the berets and the leather jackets and the sunglasses, it doesn't get better than that.
Oh, yeah. Like, and all the art.
It's the best. Oh, yeah.
No, everything.
It's as good as it gets. Oh, and the way that, like, you know, like, you know, they juxtapose it really well in the movie, because they'll have the white guys just shouting slogans like, you know, no pigs in our community. No pigs in our community. And then a couple of scenes later, they'll flash to the Panthers doing the same thing, but they're like singing.
Yeah.
And it sounds really nice.
Yeah.
It's like, they killed Fred Hampton yeah. or whatever. And you're like, damn.
I know.
Fuck.
I know.
Yeah, anyway, sorry.
Well, you know, honestly, especially like personally, I'm so done with like the activism cycle here that I've grown up in and was part of, have been sure. part of for so long. I am so sick of the chants. I'm so sick of walking in circles. I'm so sick of it all. And like, it feels so stale. And so to be thrown back into that moment. And like, I mean, and the film portrayed it well, but I also, you know, went back and watched a bunch of clips, a bunch of footage.
Sure.
And it really is those marches, those moments, they crackle. Like that you want to be there, in the same way that when we talked about part one of the Che movie, where you want to be in the Cuban Revolution, you want to be doing it. You know, the Black Panthers is a moment where, like, you want to be part of that. That's something that I would be so proud to have been part of that.
Mm-hmm.
Which I can't say of a lot of the activist work that I do now. I'm proud of doing stuff, I guess, but it doesn't have the same feeling. It doesn't have that
sure, yeah,
that cool factor, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's you mentioned in what we discussed in the first episode about how I believe what you said was like, you watch Shay part one, and you go, "Why aren't we doing this? Like, this is amazing. This is so triumphant and amazing and cool. And like, why aren't we doing this or whatever?" And then the answer to that question is part two.
Yeah,
and I actually feel like in an American context, particularly. Like, this movie is the answer to that question.
Yeah.
Because it's more true to what your experience is going to be like, and particularly what it used to be like, in a North American context where you're trying to, turn things around from the center of the Imperial Corps.
Yeah.
And, just getting, absolutely rat fucked and owned by various intelligence and law enforcement agencies.
Yeah. Well, and internal contradictions too. I mean, one thing that I thought, you know, the film didn't make any attempt, and I'm fine with this. This isn't a criticism, but the film didn't make any attempt to sort of link that moment to the present in any way. There was no, you know, there was no sort of like, you know, 50 years later, da da da, like they really kind of left that alone. But I mean, I couldn't help thinking about when, in the aftermath of Ferguson, the uprisings in Ferguson, you know, systematically since then, the leaders of the Ferguson protests have been assassinated.
It's really, that's some, and if that sounds conspiracy pilled to you, like, Google this.
Oh, yeah.
Like, do some digging into it. It isn't completely insane. It's Epstein shit. Like it's just like it feels almost intentionally designed.
Yeah.
To make you go insane.
Yeah.
With how obvious it is.
It's so like, obvious. It's so obvious. I mean, and I think that too connects us back to the Fred Hampton stuff because the murder of Fred Hampton was so obvious. And at the time, even it was well known. It was widely understood. Widely understood is maybe a stretch, but let me put it this way. It was in the media regularly, the questions that were being raised about the operation in which Fred Hampton was killed. I watched the footage, and I'm going to talk a lot while we talk about the movie. I'm going to talk a lot about the documentary, the 1971 documentary, The Murder of Fred Hampton.
Which is great. I also watched it.
Right. It's, and it's really
it's
good.
It's also brilliant. It's kind of the I would be very surprised if the makers of this film didn't watch it.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Because it seems like so much of the stuff that's in this movie is also to some degree either mentioned or directly lifted from the 1971 documentary because one really wise decision by the filmmakers in this was to use basically all real Fred Hampton speeches
mm-hmm.
for all of the scenes of him doing like making appearances and giving speeches and et cetera. But most of them are included in the 71 documentary, which I found interesting. And it actually really gave me some appreciation for Daniel Kaluuya's performance as Fred Hampton, because he really does capture Fred's cadence, his mannerisms, his manner of speaking, and his, you know, like animal magnetism, basically. Mm-hmm. Like you're just drawn to him. And it's doubly impressive because as I always forget, Daniel Kaluuya is actually British.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's well performed. The film is really well performed. It's really well put together. I think I'm probably going to end up having a slightly less. I mean, I don't know. We haven't pre-discussed this, so I don't know how many stars you're going to give it. I might be a little lower, but I certainly don't have any beef with the performances at all. And just to jump back to what we were talking about a moment ago, you know, saying that what's happening to the leaders of Ferguson, the systematic assassinations, is pretty widely known by anyone who looks for it. The murder of Fred Hampton was very obviously Or let me say this, the investigation into what happened was such an obvious sham that you see in that 1971 documentary, the chief of police is being called to task for it by regular ass journalists in Chicago in the aftermath. Like they themselves, I mean, it's a reminder that we used to have real journalists, you know, who despite probably, like they probably weren't Panther sympathizers, but they clearly knew that this story like stank. It stank to heaven and they knew it. And so they confronted the chief of police about, you know, the cop's version of events. So just like the aftermath of Ferguson, the murder of Fred Hampton was so obviously a police execution that one almost has to think they wanted it to be known. That they wanted the word to be out that the FBI is assassinating Panthers.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I don't know if I'm maybe I'm slightly off on this. But it also seems with regard to the journalist thing that you mentioned, like it seems like there used to be a lot less like moral capitulation among journalists in terms of like when something happens like this now, like with the Ferguson stuff or whatever, there would just, it seems like so many journalists are just immediately like, oh, well, you know, there's a lot of crazy conspiracy minded people out there. And, you know, law enforcement, this is their side of the story.
Yeah.
Whereas 50 years ago, it would just be more like, well, look, here's the evidence. It looks like they killed someone extrajudicially. It doesn't really matter what I think of the parties involved.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't matter who I sympathize with. We were supposed to have laws and we're supposed to have like, you know, like journalists. It's so funny because they think of themselves as people who are like upholders of the truth and the rule of law or whatever. And it's like, if they actually were that, it would be a semi-respectable job, because you're supposed to look at a situation like this and just go, this stinks.
Yeah.
This looks like a bunch of bullshit.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, you know, and adding into the, what, you know, whatever the, whatever your political affiliations are in the whole situation are totally irrelevant. It's an especially galling like version of the, you know, like Trayvon Martin thing where it's like, oh, well, here's a picture of him smoking weed or whatever. Like, it's just it's very watching the documentary was very it made me very sad for the state of modern journalism and just discourse in general, because I was like, holy shit, people seem to have their fucking heads on a little bit better when it comes to this kind of thing back then. But I don't know.
It's like, you know, it's like at some level at that point, you know, wrongly, incorrectly, but for whatever, you know, reason, historical moment, the majority of sort of mainstream journalists basically believed in the system. Like they believed in American democracy. They believed in American journalism and free media. And so they weren't afraid to confront, like a corrupt, lying police chief, a guy who's obviously lying about the murder of Fred Hampton. They're not afraid to confront him because they believe that, like, you know, the system is good. This guy has sort of broken the law. He's broken the way the system works. And we need to fix the system because the system is good. And if the system were functioning properly, things would be good. Whereas today, journalists are so completely nihilistic about the world in which they're operating.
Yeah.
They know full well that the system is a sham. They know absolutely without a doubt. There's no part of them that has any kind of idealistic belief in the way the system works. So they know that they have to do cover for the cops. They know what they're doing when they write those passive voice, you know, a gun was discharged, bullets, you know, landed somewhere inside the body of someone.
Like, as our,
you
know, mutual friend Vias has put it, the gun grew legs.
Yeah. Like they know what they're doing when they do that. And they're doing that because they know the system is a sham and they know that like justice is not ever going to be served. Whereas it's almost like in, at least in, you know, in that moment, those journalists believed that, like, the system would work. It would ultimately flush out the bad guys, and that might be the police, that might be the Panthers, but the bad guys would get flushed out by the system. So they actually confronted the cops. And those scenes are great.
Whereas now the only thing journalists really believe in is self-preservation.
Yeah.
It is wild to see in the documentary how blatantly obvious it is that they're full of shit.
Yeah.
The Chicago PD, that is, because one of the central pieces of evidence is, as you see in the film as well, the front door to their apartment. Is it an apartment? I think it is an apartment.
Yeah.
That they shot up. And they try to essentially, the police department try to essentially be like, oh, well, here's this hole. And this hole came from a shot from a Black Panther. And as they mentioned at the end of the movie, there was one shot. There was actually, it turns out, they found out later, one shot fired by a Black Panther. But it was almost certainly discharged when the guy holding the gun was shot. So it was discharged by accident, right. Essentially.
Yeah.
But the hole that they are pointing to is very obviously a hole from a nail.
Yeah.
That they've pried out, like they've pried the nail out, because they show in the documentary earlier in the they show the Chicago PD like talking about this door or whatever, and then they flash back to, they have footage of the Panthers looking at the door like 12 hours before it's submitted into evidence, and there's no hole.
Yeah.
Like it's and there's tons of stuff like that is just like, holy shit, these guys are just blatantly lying, which I mean, I guess we shouldn't be surprised by, but it is very galling to see.
Yeah. I mean, I think what is surprising about it is just that they get confronted on it, and so they look bad. You know, like, the lying is probably just as brazen as it would be today, but because these journalists are sort of doing their job, like, you actually see the chief of police, you know, get uncomfortable, get visibly uncomfortable, not know how to answer the questions, refuse to answer the questions. You know, there's like, so you actually get that feeling of like, oh my God, I can't believe they're just lying like this. Whereas, you know, we get sort of gaslit into you know, this process now where, you know, someone interviews the chief of police and there's no hard questions, and, you know, it's as though everyone just accepts the police version of events. Which, I mean, I don't know how much that matters at the end of the day. Like, I mean, my political commitment isn't to, like, let's just get a better journal, you know, keep the system as it is and have better journalists. Like, that's not really my, you know.
No, yeah.
So at the end of the day, I don't know if it matters that much, but you know, I do think, like, clearly one of the things you're making a Fred Hampton film in 2021, you know, you are speaking to a 2021 audience, and, you know, we are in a moment of, I mean, I know it's kind of on pause right now, but the summer of 2020 is one of the largest, uprisings, you know, in sort of Black America in the last 20 years. That was a pretty big deal what happened in 2020. And none of the factors that led to it have gone away, you know, police violence.
No, if anything, they've gotten worse.
Yeah, exactly.
So. I mean, certainly here, like, it's, I you know, we're very limited as Canadians, I think, in terms of what we hear about going on in the States. A lot of locally specific stuff gets washed out and just doesn't really necessarily reach us for a lot of different reasons. But certainly, where I live in British Columbia, the police violence problem just gets worse every day, and more gets, I don't want to say reported on, because it's not necessarily in the news or whatever, but we hear about it more and more every day. There was a really brutal decampment that just happened on Hastings Street in Vancouver, which, for those of you that don't know, is maybe the poorest neighborhood in Canada. Certainly the poorest neighborhood in British Columbia. Yeah, there was a the most infamous image was of a police officer just beating the absolute shit out of a guy with a walker. So yeah, I don't know. I just wanted to slide that in there. Because I mean, I think the anti-police message of the Panthers and of this movie may resonate with people now even more than the anti-racist message.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you know, the interesting thing to think about it is okay, so if the climate or the context of police violence is still very, very bad, which it definitely is, and that's going to resonate with people, what is very different, what is really lacking, is the Black Panther Party.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? Like, it is a glaring omission from the actual, you know, moment of 2022 now, that there isn't a Black Panther Party. There is nothing even close to a Black Panther Party. In fact, the only thing you might hold up as a possible comparison point would be Black Lives Matter, which is a movement that, for whatever moments it had some hope and some strength and some good stuff going, has completely disgraced itself in the decade or so since it emerged.
It's, it's funny you mentioned that, because I was thinking about that, because that is a thing you'll read a lot about when you read reviews of this movie, which was almost universally well received, actually, which is interesting. But one of the things you'll see across like almost every review is people drawing a parallel to what they call the Black Lives Matter movement, which I sort of take umbrage with a little bit, because I don't really think, like, Black Lives Matter is more a slogan than it is a movement. And there is an organization called Black Lives Matter, but it doesn't seem to, let's just say the utility of it is dubious at best, I guess, is what I'll just leave it at that. Because I don't want to get too into it, and I don't want to talk out my ass because I don't know all the ins and outs of the organization. But it seems like every time I hear about something to do with the actual organization that is called Black Lives Matter, it is a bad thing rather than a good thing. So
and even at its best, you know, even to the extent that, and I take your point, you know, movement may be a stretch, but to the extent that there was you know, there were mobilizations of people around the slogan and into a kind of movement against police violence, specifically racial police violence, that emerges out of Ferguson and then stretches through the last, you know, decade. And obviously, you know, then has a big moment in 2020. Like, as much as there are really positive things that happened in all of those moments, there was never a Black Panther Party. And specifically, there was never any attempt, I shouldn't say never any, but there was a really only limited attempt to connect the problems of, you know, racial police violence with class struggle more generally, you know, with the need to confront not just the police, but the state itself, and not just the state itself, but the entire economic system that the state upholds and that upholds the state, all of which the Black Panthers did. I mean, the Black Panthers did educational work. They did community work. They were building things that were meant to last. And, you know, I will concede the point that they didn't last. It did peter out, but it lasted a lot longer. And I would suggest that it had a much more profound impact than anything of the last decade has thus far. And we desperately need that Black Panther Party. We desperately need to be building organizations that can link the immediate reality of police violence with that broader and, you know, admittedly abstract, but very real dynamic of, like, this is class struggle. This is class struggle in the United States, just like it's class struggle in Canada, just like it's class struggle in, you know, Bolivia and Venezuela and Brazil and everywhere else. We need to be linked with all of those movements around the world. I mean, that's one of the things the Panthers did, was they linked with revolutionary movements around the world. And I mean, the Panthers are such a cool organization on so many levels, such a sophisticated political party with such a sophisticated ideological analysis. And we need it so badly. And its absence, I think one of the, you know, I just kept thinking as I watched the film, like, the absence of this right now, like, how badly we need this. You know, we need a Fred Hampton more than ever. We need a Fred Hampton.
yeah, like the thing that I guess keeps coming to mind for me is the scene. It's a great scene, and I don't know where this was taken from, because I don't remember it. I don't think it was in the documentary, but there is a great line where it's kind of his first, if I remember correctly, yeah, it's his first big speech that he gives in the movie, and it's in response to, I don't know, I don't think he's giving a speech to, he's not giving a speech to Panthers, he's giving a speech to just a group of, like, black activists, basically, and the person before him is talking about how, like, there's, like, a college that's being renamed Malcolm X College, or whatever.
Right.
And he comes out and he basically says, like, I can't remember what he says exactly, but he's basically makes the point that's like, oh, Malcolm X College, that's amazing. You still have to pay to go there. Like, yeah. You still, you know, like, you know, what's that going to do changing the name of the college? Like, it's great. Good for you. Yeah. I'm not saying it's bad to do that. Like, that's nice, but it doesn't really mean anything. And one of the things that he says that is such a good line and such a good slogan is he says, political power does not flow from the sleeve of a dashiki. Political power flows from the barrel of a gun.
Yeah.
This is a thing that kind of thing, like, when there are a lot of people that hear that tense up when they hear that.
Yeah.
But it is 1000% true.
Yeah.
Like, what, and this is always kind of it's a thing that I bring up a lot is like, well, okay, let's start with the fact that the police all have guns.
Yeah.
Right. So the idea that, like, guns for self-defense or whatever is like a scary thing. Well, it shouldn't be, because we all have people who are strapped with a gun directly available to them walking through our communities every day. Yeah. That are largely completely unaccountable to us. And for fuck's sake, we're arguably even more unaccountable back then.
Yeah.
And I make this point a lot. It isn't to devalue the accomplishments of nonviolent, like, sort of peace loving, like, activists in the civil rights movement. Obviously, leaders like Medgar Evers and Martin Luther King were very important, and also, I think, sadly, have had their radical, the radical element, yes, to their politics shaved off considerably,
yes, 100%.
By the flow of time. But there is a lot of, I think, miscasting of 60s radicals in particular, but radicals in the civil rights movement as being people who peacefully marched and talked a lot about civil rights and human rights. And they did a bunch of marches that were peaceful, and eventually the government came around and did what was right because of those marches or whatever. And that, yeah, isn't to say that the March on Washington or whatever else didn't have an impact. It obviously did. But what is at least as important and gets completely left out of these stories is that while that was happening, there was also the Nation of Islam and the Black Panthers who had guns and were willing to die for, yeah, what they believed in, largely.
Yeah, and, to say nothing of... No, sorry, finish thought.
No, and I just think that, you know, if you want to take, like, a carrot and stick approach or whatever, like, yeah, regardless of whether you're an incrementalist or your interests are purely revolutionary and you want to just upend everything, or however you want to look at it, I think you make the case that the concessions that were made by the federal government to get voting rights to Black people, to end segregation, et cetera, you needed a large group of armed people who were willing to die for what they believed in to sufficiently spook the bad actors into making concessions. Or,
yeah, I mean,
none,
yeah,
of this would have ever happened, or it would have taken much, much, much longer, you know?
Yeah, the state needed to be in a position where it had to give something back in order to soften the edge of what was a genuinely revolutionary movement. I mean, that's the thing about the Panthers, that in particular, and you're right. I mean, there's also the Nation of Islam. There's also, you know, the AIM, American Indian Movement. You know, there are some of those more adventurous groups like the Weather Underground, which, you know, I wouldn't endorse, yes, the Weather Underground, but they're the very fact that they were on the kind of horizon, that they were part of that constellation of what was happening. There was this understanding that the state needed to co-opt that, because the more aggressive it was, the more militant it was, then the more of a risk it posed if they didn't deal with it. And the more difficult it would be to just flat out repress. I mean, you know, the Panthers were hard to repress. It's a lot easier to do repression of unarmed protesters than it is to do repression of the Panthers, because they will shoot back. And despite what police propaganda would have you think, cops are afraid of getting shot. Cops do not want to get shot. That's why they didn't rush into that school to save the children from a school shooter, because they're afraid of being shot. That's why they wear, you know, 16 tons of body armor and carry, you know, the most heavily. Like, they don't want to get shot. So when a movement like
the Black Panthers, why they all look like the fucking commando elite from Small Soldiers, with just a fucking weapon and a bullet belt and a fucking bulletproof vest, like everywhere.
Somewhere underneath all of that is a person, but you wouldn't know. They could be RoboCop. And the Panthers forced the state to recognize that if it was going to repress the Panthers, it was going to take casualties in doing so. And that fact alone made the state more willing to concede, to make concessions. And limited concessions, sure, with a lot of contradictions and a lot of which have been taken back. But it is precisely the militants of the Panthers and their sort of adjacent organizations that made them as effective as they were. So, you know, again, you know, you think about the present and you think about the fact that we are losing. We're losing every struggle. And, you know, let's take it back to that line you pointed out, the one about power doesn't flow from a dashiki, it flows from a barrel of a gun. Like, the first part of it, let's focus on that for a moment, too. Power doesn't flow from representation. We have become obsessed.
Or cultural signifiers.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. We have become obsessed as a culture with those signifiers, those empty signifiers. I mean, the movie Black Panther, not the movie we're discussing, the superhero movie Black Panther, right?
Which honestly would maybe be worth doing an episode about, too. Yeah, because it's interesting.
Like, It is. But I mean, it's a really good also encapsulation of the way in which like a relatively empty signifier, you know, was treated as though it was really, really important. And then very easily co-opted, you know, white people doing the Wakanda Forever shit.
And Ryan Coogler, who directed it, produced this movie, interestingly.
Oh, that is interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, one of the producers anyways. And we'll talk. I do want to get into the production of the movie a little bit in a sec. But another thing that ties into that I thought was wonderful is, and it's a very striking scene and a very striking sort of image when the Panthers go into the young Patriots like sort of clubhouse or whatever, and they have the big Confederate flag pointing there, and things get a little heated, and it's, you know, I mean, the I would never, you know, I would never fly that flag. I think it's a hate symbol, basically. And their defensive flying, it is not a good one. You know, it's a, they say, well, this is just to remind us of our Southern heritage and, you know, our culture or whatever. And it's a, there's a whole kind of scuffle because the one of the Panthers calls them, the overseers.
Yeah.
Because the guy says, hey, my parents were sharecroppers or whatever.
And, yeah.
And then Fred just says, well, what if the overseer and the slave had teamed together and slit the master's throat? Yeah. We might not all be sitting in this stinky ass building right now. And that's a scene that actually, funnily enough, so the first time I saw this movie when I was laid off from work, a friend of mine who's in the IMT, was like, hey, do you want to do some reading groups or whatever? And I was like, yeah, I've never read any of this shit. Sure, why not? You know, like, I know everybody, people have their opinions about the IMT and like whatever. I don't care about that. It was an opportunity to read Marx and Engels and Lenin with some semi like-minded people and kind of gain a better understanding of it than I would have on my own.
Yeah.
And one of the things that they did was also screen this movie. And this scene was discussed widely in those meetings.
Okay.
And it was very funny because there was a lot of the thing that you sort of talked about of A lot, like, certainly just I'll spare you the whole story, but just by saying a lot of people very neurotically trying to deal with that scene and trying to be like sufficiently like, you know, oh, I don't want to center my whiteness or whatever. It was very funny. Like, it was very funny because it was just like, oh, okay, yeah, we're all going to do posting in real life for a second or whatever. But the real thing that everyone, that I realized everyone missed, and I only noticed it on my third watch, was when he said, if my house is on fire, my culture is water and escape. And I thought that was brilliant because it is sort of like, and I actually think it's funny to hear that coming from Hampton, because one of the things the Panthers actually did brilliantly was bringing Marxism into their cultural context. Like, they did that really, really well. But it does illustrate sort of what the meaty center of the problem is. And I love that. I love that quote, because it's a perfect encapsulation of like, none of this stuff matters when we get down to when we really get down to brass tacks and we're talking about life and death.
Yeah. Yeah. Representation, like, is not going to do it. It's not going to cut it. And like, it doesn't matter how many Obamas, it doesn't matter how many, you know, symbolic, expressions of, you know, of Black culture in media or, you know, Black culture in politics or whatever, like, racism persists, and racism joined with capitalist exploitation and working together, like, it persists, and it, like, you have to fight these things at their material center. Like, what gives racism power? It's capitalism. What gives racism power is the fact that racists can do something about it. They have the material means to continue to be racist and to have it have an impact. If racism wasn't backed by material power, if racism didn't have the cops with guns to defend it, then racism would be a much more parochial problem. It'd be a much more provincial kind of thing. It is an existential problem because racism is joined with material power, and racists have material power. And that's, you know, that's what Fred and the Black Panthers articulated so well. And they always did so in a way that, I mean, it's not like they were dismissive of culture or pretending that culture wasn't important. No. They embodied Black culture and instilled pride in it, but they did so from the standpoint of, our enemy here is the capitalist class. Our enemy is the representatives of the capitalist class, the police. And our goal is to build a better society and build stronger communities. That's why stuff like the breakfast program is so important, right? Mm-hmm. It's because they weren't just about struggling against a bad system. They were offering material replacements for it. They were saying, like, here's what we want instead, and we're going to actively do it. Again, like, there is nothing like that right now, not on any mass scale. And we desperately need it. We desperately need movements that are able to both criticize the present and also start embodying what the future would be. Which, I mean, this shit is hard. This shit is very, very hard. There's a reason we're not doing it, right? And the fact that the FBI murked Fred Hampton is part of the reason we are where we are. Like, it set us back.
Well, yeah, and that's why I'm always sort of a little suspicious of people who say, well, you know, yada, 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 the Black Panthers were yada, 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 but like, they're not around anymore. So, you know, they didn't really succeed or whatever. And it's like, well, okay, yeah, but that doesn't exist in a vacuum. There's a reason they didn't just fail on their own. They were not allowed to fail on their own merit.
Exactly.
They were interfered with. And this was I was having this conversation with my wife the other day because she's been doing this thing where she just realized, like, she's like, my knowledge of geography is shit. She has a coworker from Tunisia who just started, who's like her, she manages a restaurant and he is the other manager there. And she was like, I don't know shit about Tunisia. I don't know shit about like huge swaths of Africa. And that's bad. I should know about you know, I should know a little bit about every country in the world, hopefully. And she started reading about, she was reading the, about the, she's just reading the Wikipedia article for Burkina Faso. And she's just like reading it, and I'm like watching TV. And she would just every few minutes be like, oh, did you know this? And it was just like watching her slowly be like, oh,
Thomas Sankara
pilled. They did all this really, yeah, like they did all this really progressive stuff in the late 80s. And then, isn't that crazy? How did they get so, why are they such a bad place to live now?
Yeah.
You know, it just like, it just slowly being like, and she was like, holy shit. And I was like, yeah, I've been telling you, like, you know, like, obviously, you know, she knows, but like, it was funny to, you know, it, she, a lot of the reasons she knows is because I'm fucking on about it all the time or whatever. So it was interesting to see her, and we were talking about it, and I was like, this is why it bothers me so much when people say shit like, well, you know, socialism doesn't work, look at blah, blah, blah. Communism doesn't work, look at blah, blah, blah. And this is not to say that there haven't been projects that have failed on their own merit. There have been, or at least have their, the decisions of the actors involved did certainly contribute heavily to failure or dissolution or whatever. But what I, what the metaphor that I used is like, imagine you own a house and then, and you have a neighbor. And your neighbor moves into the house next to you and they try to build a fence. And every time they try to, and they, so they try to build this fence and you're like, I don't want their that fence there. So you murder them and their entire family.
Yeah.
And so then another person moves into the house next to you and then they try to build a fence and then you murder them and their entire family.
Fences
don't
work.
And then another person moves in. Yeah. And you just keep doing this. And every person who moves into the house next to you, you murder them and their entire family. Yeah. And then you say, well, building a fence on this property just doesn't work. Yeah. You know, it's like, I have some time, like I have a mild, slight bit of time, maybe for someone who says that if they've lived in that house. But I do not have time for it from the from anyone who lives in the house that's been killing
the murdering house.
Yeah, exactly. And that is what it's like to hear Americans say that, you know.
Yeah.
So
okay. So this, I feel like we're at a good place for me to ask what I think is like the toughest question for me about the film, and I'm going to ask it to you.
Sure.
So we're at this stage in our conversation where we've established a few things. We've established that the Panthers ruled, that we need the Panthers, and that our moment lacks the Black Panthers to our detriment. And then we've sort of said, but, you know, this, there's a reason for this. Part of the reason we don't have a Black Panthers right now is because they murked Fred Hampton, and they did this, and they did this to all of those kinds of movements. That brings me to William O'Neill.
Okay. Yeah.
And what I think is the most sort of controversial point about the film and the thing that I saw people argue about the most.
Sure.
And,
yeah. And, okay.
Yeah. And this is the thing that I'm the most conflicted on.
Okay.
But I want to put it to you first. What do you think of the film's portrayal of the snitch, William O'Neill?
Well, so I've seen a few different points of comparison for this, and there's a review I want to get to at some point. That is, I mentioned the guy in our first episode. Let me just, I can find his name here in a second here. Mick LaSalle, as you may remember from episode one.
Who gave
the hilarious review of Shay. He gave this movie a very, very good review. And so as a pretext to answering your question, I'm just going to read from it.
Okay.
Because I thought this was fascinating, because as we know, he thought that Shay was pure hagiography, just a communist fever dream that was just sucking Che Guevara's dick the entire time, which like we did not think. Right. But he liked this movie and he had a very different reading on it. I want to skip ahead through some of the more bullshitty stuff. I don't need to read you the plot of the movie. Okay. Judas and the Black Messiah puts us into the shoes of the man it's identifying as Judas, and makes our identification with O'Neill all the more reflexive by having him played by Lakeith Stanfield, normally a sympathetic lead. What would you do when faced with a prison term? Judas and the Black Messiah is an odd, compelling film in that its presentation of everyone it portrays is so balanced that the point of view is hard to identify. But perhaps the point of view is less important than the movie's ability to capture a historical moment. If O'Neill is the Judas of the piece, then Fred Hampton of the Black Panthers is the Black Messiah in this equation. But calling him that is ironic, in that this is what FBI Chief J. Edgar Hoover called him. It's what Hoover feared, a black leader who could unite the civil rights movement, the youth movement, and the anti-war movement. By 1969, when the film takes place, Hoover had long made it his mission to destroy whoever he thought could become a black messiah, including the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Judas and the Black Messiah doesn't follow any typical movie pattern. It's not about an undercover operative who switches allegiances, and then in brackets, deep cover, and this is going to be a theme. There's a few of these in brackets here. It's not about a sniveling creep whose actions lead to the assassination of the death of a remarkable man, the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. And it's not about a good guy who goes undercover and experiences the daily terror of possible exposure, Donnie Brasco. It's none of those things, and yet it contains elements of all of those things. In a sense, the most impressive aspect of the film is that it doesn't seem like it should hold together, and yet it does. Hampton, as presented here, is decisive and forthright. He has committed his life to a cause and complete awareness of what this means. I'm not going to die in a car wreck. I'm not going to die from a bad heart, he says in a speech. I'm going to die for the people. Great scene, by the way.
Yeah.
He's a 21-year-old man with everything on the line, and Kaluuya plays him with force, magnetism, and gravity. He's by far the better man, and yet every time O'Neill comes close to having his cover blown, we tense up. A lifetime of moviegoing has trained us to root for the protagonist, especially as we can see how alone he is. The FBI doesn't care about him because his safety is not a priority. They've actually sent him out to go undercover in Chicago, his native city where people know him. So perhaps the bad guy in this construction is O'Neill's FBI handler. Except no, the agent is no caricature. At one point, he's talking to Hoover, Martin Sheen and Jabba the Hutt makeup, who's spouting racist nonsense, and he looks appalled. So is the villain Hoover? Perhaps, but he's so removed from the action that he's more like a symbol. This is, in essence, the achievement of Judas and the Black Messiah. In addition to its being beautifully shot and carefully directed by Shaka King, and an entertaining film, it presents an arresting situation. No one is entirely evil, and yet something entirely evil happens anyway. Moreover, we understand how it happens and why it happens. And there's a little bit more after that, but that kind of gets the point across.
Man, that pisses me off. That's not right.
Yeah, it's a hugely even the most cynical critic of this movie, I think, should be able to see that it does certainly have a point of view.
Oh, yeah.
What the point of view is debatable.
Yes.
But I also thought it was funny because I haven't seen Deep Impact and I've seen the assassination of Jesse James, but it was a long time ago. But Donnie Brasco is a favorite of mine. I've seen it many, many times. It's been a while since I've seen it, but I also think he misunderstands that movie because I don't think that Donnie Brasco necessarily takes pains to make you think that he's a good guy at all, really. There's no real reason for you to think Joe Pistone is a good guy unless you just take it as a given that, like, oh, he's the cops and he's infiltrating the mafia. What actually happens in Donnie Brasco is over a long course of time, you actually kind of start to begrudgingly like the mobsters.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the movie is ultimately a movie about a guy who is in the life so long that he eventually grows to be family of these guys and then turns on all his friends, puts them in jail, and does it all for, like, a little medal that is given to him in a ceremony in front of, like, two people. And loses his wife and child in the process and makes, like, almost no money doing it. And I think, for me, when I watch it, it seems like the movie is kind of almost more like, what was this all for?
Yeah.
You know? And it's not necessarily to say that it's an anti-cop movie by any means. Like, I just think it's a little more complicated than he gives it credit for.
But that, in some ways, I think is a parallel with this at some mm-hmm. level. I mean, I think mm-hmm. O'Neill is framed. And, you know, it's funny because when you were reading the review, I was with him actually to a point, and then suddenly sure. I wasn't. And I was with him to the point when he sort of talks about, like, obviously Fred Hampton is a protagonist, but in many ways we're sympathetic to William O'Neill as well. We're sympathetic to the snitch, and we've been trained to be sympathetic to our protagonist. We're seeing it through his eyes. And mm-hmm. Now, for me at this point, I agree with the review saying that. I think that is accurate about the film.
Where it really falls apart, though, is saying that you're yeah. supposed to think that the FBI guy
yeah.
is anything other than a total piece of shit.
Exactly. And if you come I away actually, with that, like, that's you're telling on yourself.
Absolutely.
Because that film does not make him into a good guy. I will grant you, like, and I will say this, it was one of my least favorite scenes in the movie, that scene he describes when J. Edgar Hoover is being aggressively racist and yeah. the FBI agent is uncomfortable with it. It's like, don't do that. Don't give me some throwaway reason to be sympathetic to this FBI guy. No, fuck that. I hated that scene. One of the dumbest scenes in the film.
That's the point of it, though, personally. I'll get to what I think about it in a second.
My point would be this. It would be the existence of that scene made this reviewer, who we know to be a reactionary,
yeah.
it made him happy. Mm-hmm. He liked it. It yeah, gave him totally. The excuse of like, oh, you see, there is no evil. The FBI guy's doing his best, too. He's not racist. So I really, yeah. really didn't like that scene.
So I guess I will say, like, I you could argue pretty strongly for it not to be included in the film, and I would not necessarily disagree with you, but here's what I think about the way that the whole thing is handled. So Fred Hampton is portrayed in the movie as a Christ-like figure. He has very few flaws as a human being. Like, he is really, really, really presented as kind of a Superman. And rightly so, as far as I'm concerned. Like, aside from me maybe being a little rough around the edges and a little, you know, scared, perhaps from the perspective of like his wife and child or whatever, a little too willing to die for the movement or whatever. Like, he is presented as a Christ-like figure, hence the title of the movie. And the thing about Christ-like figures is that it's really hard to make a compelling movie if you center it around that.
Right.
And so I think the decision to center it more around, and it's only, you know, I would say they both have about an equal amount of screen time. So it's not even really fair to necessarily say that it's focused on O'Neill. It's just that O'Neill is the only character in the movie who has an arc, really, right. or who I wouldn't necessarily, I would. He's the only dynamic character,
yeah.
really.
Yeah.
And I think that there is a difference between portraying that and being sympathetic to it. And I guess what I mean by that is, I mean, the movie is sympathetic to him, but not necessarily in the way that one might think. Like, I think that it is reasonable to look at what happens in the movie. And this is sort of buried because of the actors they decided to cast. But William O'Neill was 17 when he got stopped for stealing a car and got recruited into the, like, recruited as an FBI informant. And Fred Hampton was 21 when he died. Mm-hmm. These were young, young men. And I will defend the casting of older men to play them because I just don't think we make 21-year-olds like that anymore. Like, it's just a totally different, it's a totally different ballgame now. But I think that centering the movie kind of around O'Neill is more of an it's more of a narrative choice than it is a case of the audience or the filmmaker sympathizing with one particular character. Because what I think you're meant to take away is that you can feel bad for O'Neill in the sense that he was coerced and he was put in a difficult position and definitely didn't really understand what he was doing until it was too late. But you don't have to like him. And I don't think you're meant to like him, really. I think you're meant to feel claustrophobic. I think you're meant to feel gross. And I think you're meant to feel that even though he is the Judas in the story, the real, like, evil presence in the movie is the FBI.
Yeah.
And I think the casting of Jesse Plemons was so perfect as his FBI handler, because nobody, if you've seen Breaking Bad, and he is really, that show went downhill in my opinion, and he is really the best part of the later seasons of Breaking Bad. Nobody does nice guy, pure evil like Jesse Plemons. And yeah. He is so there, like the scene where there's a scene where he explains to him that he like brags to him that, I prosecuted these cops that gave this black guy who was trying to register voters to the KKK and kill him or whatever. And, you know, the Panthers, they're just the flip side of that.
Mm-hmm.
And there is nothing in the movie that is portrayed that would make you think that that is true in any way whatsoever.
Agreed.
That you're meant to see that and be like, this guy is so full of shit.
In fact, unless I'm mistaken, I think that right from that scene, they cut back to Panther stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure they cut back almost immediately to free breakfast stuff. Like they really make it's the director is at pains to say this guy's lying. Don't believe it.
Exactly. There's the scene that you mentioned, and it's a scene that people criticize, and I do understand why people criticize it. But to me, I get a slightly different reading because I think it shows the real face of law enforcement, and particularly like the real face of high level law enforcement and the politics of law enforcement and the FBI, which is, wow, you know, I'm really personally squeamish about this, and I don't like the way he's talking about black people, but I'm still just going to go along with everything. And he does. There's nothing like you can read it however you want, but the fact that he like doesn't think it's nice that they had one of their informants kill an innocent person and that J. Edgar Hoover is such an inveterate Nazi, basically. That doesn't change how he behaves in any way. And so, I mean, I guess it's open to interpretation what you're supposed to think about it, but I didn't think it made him more sympathetic at all. I think if anything, it made him less sympathetic because it really contrasts with Hampton and the Panthers who all truly believe in something.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this FBI agent and O'Neill don't really believe in anything other than their own personal advancement.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can draw the parallel with Donnie Brasco just in the sense that, you know, at the very end, he gets a gas station out of it or whatever, but he's like, this sucks. I hate this.
Yeah.
And if there's a lesson here, and I mean, it's a funny lesson to draw, but it's useful anyways. I think that the lesson is if your choice is between prison or having to work for law enforcement, you should always pick prison because at least prison ends.
Yeah. Yeah.
This does not end and it never did. And he eventually killed himself.
Well, and that's the punch. I mean, that's so for me, I think the most important and most impactful point in this film is that super at the end that just says the text comes up and just says, and I think they give you a short clip from his interview in 1989 where he admits to having been an FBI agent, and that he committed suicide that night, the night that it aired.
And that is slightly, I think there's an implication that happens that is true, but his segment didn't air that night. Just the beginning of the documentary did. So it's people have accused it of drawing more of a parallel than was, but I think that's bullshit.
Yeah.
I think if you think that this guy, that didn't contribute to him being depressed, I don't think you're.
Oh yeah, I mean,
serious.
I read the full transcript of that interview, that 1989 interview, and I mean, it's pretty heartbreaking, truthfully, because
I know.
You know, you do get the sense, and I think the film portrayed this well. And I mean, I'm still unsure whether I like the decision to make this film and make this be the film and make the film be about the snitch and a somewhat, you know, arguably sympathetic portrayal of him. But I also do think that, like, the sympathetic portrayal is not in and of itself a bad thing because he is a sympathetic person insofar as he got sucked into this. He gets involved with the party and likes it. And that's, I think, very clear. They show that, I think, in the film. They do a good job of showing that at various moments he's like, no, you know what? Like, these are my people now, and I've learned a lot, and this feels good, and I don't like that I'm snitching. And, you know, like, he doesn't seem to be motivated entirely by fear of being caught. He's also motivated by the fact that he has become, in his own mind, he's become a Panther. And, you know, especially the moment after there's that big shootout and I guess Fred is in jail and he really takes charge and does a lot of the work of the rebuilding of their headquarters. And everyone's really excited about him. And it's like the only moment in the film where you can sense that he has, like, he feels good about himself. And that's reflected in at least the interview I read with him, where you really get the sense, and they show in that very contradictory thing that he says in the 1989 clip where he sort of says,
"Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that."
Right? Yeah, because it's such a strange thing where the interviewer asks basically, like, you know, what would you say to your kids about this? And he says, "Well, I'd want my kids to know that I was part of it. I was there. You know, we were doing that stuff. I was part of the struggle.
I didn't sit there like an armchair revolutionary."
Yeah.
That's what he said, which is a fucking completely bizarre thing.
It's so strange, right? But I mean, it sounds like the thing a guy says when they are just absolutely grappling and struggling with the fact that they were a fucking snitch for a movement that they believed in. And then, of course,
at least to some degree.
Yeah. I think then the fact that he commits suicide, you know, his arc is really tragic. And I think they show us the way that the FBI manipulate him. They show us the way that he tries to get out. He tries to say, "I'm not going to do this anymore." And he is pressed, and he's pressed in ways that just make it feel like he's got no options. So I think it is appropriate to characterize him that way. And I think the film ultimately does show us that the FBI is the bad guy. I think what I'm left with is a certain question of, do we need the film that portrays sympathetically the snitch? Like, is that what we needed right now? Because when I watched the film and I watched the documentary, which is a lot of the documentary is just footage of Fred Hampton giving speeches. Mm-hmm. I kind of think what we need is Fred Hampton.
Like, yeah, and I understand. I do understand that. But I mean, I guess what I would say is that there's no doubt in my mind that that you are supposed to think at the end of the movie that Fred Hampton and the Panthers were the good guys and that the FBI were the bad guys. And so for that reason, I don't really have a problem with the vessel they choose to tell that story. Because I do think ultimately, if you are a filmmaker and I'll talk about the production of the movie in a second. Like, everybody involved in this movie's number one thing that they wanted to do was make a good movie more than anything else. And I respect artistically the choice to kind of focus the story on the character that had the most interesting arc. And I think that that's true. Like, I think that from a narrative standpoint, I think you can make a strong case that this was the most interesting way to tell the story, even if it's a little squishier in terms of what point you're trying to make. Because even if you're meant to kind of you can argue about how much you're meant to sympathize with William O'Neill, but even if you're meant to completely sympathize with William O'Neill, the FBI is still the bad guy. You know what I mean? And
And you sympathize with O'Neill insofar as he regrets that he's snitching on the Panthers. Like, that's why you sympathize with him. You don't sympathize with him for the snitching. You sympathize with him because he realizes he shouldn't be snitching.
Exactly. So, and it's way more clear about that than, say, like Donnie Brasco is. Way more clear.
And I think that's true. And I mean, ultimately, I like the movie and I have... You know, it gets a good, you know, rating from me. They'll be relieved to know.
totally.
But you know, I also in my head, you know, I'm comparing it to. There's another set of things I'm comparing it to. You know, Spike Lee's Malcolm X, which also features you know, him being betrayed and assassinated by his own people. But that's not the arc. The arc is about Malcolm.
Yeah. And you certainly could have made a Malcolm X type movie about Fred Hampton. And maybe that would have also been really good. I don't know. What I will say is I would rather criticize the fact that that movie doesn't exist than I would criticize this movie for not being that movie.
Yeah. That's
so I want to talk a little bit about the production of the movie, because there's some interesting stuff that I was able to find. Normally I'd do this way earlier in the episode, but we had so much good things to, or so much interesting things to say about this one, I think. So attempts to make a Hampton biopic have existed for a long time, but this project kind of began to germinate in around 2014, but it took, you know, over half a decade to finally come together. So this is from an article by Clayton Davis in Variety called Judas and the Black Messiah, Inside the Long Struggle to Bring Fred Hampton's Story to the Screen. And I just want to read from it briefly, because there are some very funny stuff. There is some very funny stuff in here, particularly with regards to just like trying to get this movie made by the kind of people who decide what movies get made. Shaka King says about the project, "I was under the impression that if you make a movie about a Black Panther produced by the director of Black Panther, which made $1 billion, starring two of the best actors of our generation, and you have a producer and co-financier in Charles King, who is willing to put up half the budget, it's going to be a bidding war. That was not the case." There had been previous attempts by the likes of Forest Whitaker and Antoine Fuqua to dramatize Hampton's story, and those projects have been explored and announced, but somehow failed to ever make it in front of cameras. In 2014, Keith and Kenny Lucas, better known as the stand-up comedy duo, the Lucas Brothers, pitched the idea for a Fred Hampton film to several studios, selling it as Bernardo Bertolucci's The Conformist meets Martin Scorsese's The Departed. Studios like A24 and Netflix passed on the project. Even as the Lucas Brothers made the rounds in Hollywood, Will Burson, a secular Jewish comedy writer from New York, put the finishing touches on his own Hampton script entitled The Assassination of Chairman Fred Hampton by the Closet Queen Mulatto Edgar Hoover, which I think I would have been very interested to see what that movie would have been like. His story has had a more expansive approach, beginning with Hampton's mother's babysitting Emmett Till and culminating with his own funeral. Burson also failed to get much interest from various production companies. One prominent studio executive grilled him by asking, "Where's the traditional arc? What are the challenges?" Burson's response, "It's not a traditional biopic because he was not a traditional human being." Another studio executive suggested that he show Hampton learning how to speak in front of a crowd. Perhaps he gets nervous and stutters for his first outing. Burson was having none of it. "This isn't the King's Speech," he quipped. They may have been working on different projects, but Burson and the Lucas Brothers were working towards the same goal, introducing the world to Fred Hampton in a way that would inspire a new generation. In 2016, while collaborating with Shaka King on an FX pilot that didn't get picked up, the Lucas Brothers spoke with the director about the project. "He instantly knew what we wanted to do," Keith Lucas says. Actor Jermaine Fowler called King to tell him that his friend Burson had a Hampton movie that he was trying to get made. In August 2017, Burson's script version, now titled To Fred Hampton, was getting some heat with F. Gary Gray, who directed Straight Outta Compton, in talks to direct, and Casey Affleck and John Powers Middleton in negotiations to produce. Names like Jaden Smith and O'Shea Jackson Jr. were being floated to portray the chairman. I am very happy that that didn't end up happening. Burson and Shaka King opted to join forces, and King made the studio rounds again. They would express passion for the material, but they would come back with a figure that was just impossible to make this movie, especially a period film, he remembers. Another executive told the filmmaker that his $26 million budget was too high, explaining that when he crunched the numbers, an algorithm said the movie was worth far less. And then it has a quote here from Shaka King where he says, "That's when you realize that even the math in Hollywood is racist." So I thought that was very interesting and very funny.
Yeah.
Basically, eventually, the script gets in the hands of Charles King, who is the CEO of Macro. And he puts up 50% of the film's budget. And that's kind of how it's able to get made. Macro, for what it's worth, is kind of interesting. It's a multimedia platform media company that, according to its own website, represents the voices and perspectives of Black people and people of color. And it has actually made a number of critically acclaimed movies about Black stories, like Fences, Just Mercy, Mudbound, and most interestingly, Sorry to Bother You, stars Lakeith Stanfield,
and which should probably be discussed on this show.
I would definitely be down for that. It was the movie was mostly really well received, as I alluded to earlier. The only real negative thing, aside from a review in National Review, that I could find was that a former Black Panther named Eddie Conway found that Hampton was portrayed maybe just not a little more severe of a personality than he actually had. He said that the film didn't quite capture how what actually kind of like how sunny and warm and lighthearted he was. But it was well received by Hampton's widow and his son, who they sought the approval of while making the movie. One thing that I thought was very funny is that Kaluuya and Stanfield were both nominated for the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor, with Kaluuya winning a much deserved win, I would argue. But as Cal Buchanan of the New York Times put it very succinctly, I would think, he said, if Stanfield and Kaluuya are both supporting actors, then who exactly is this movie supposed to be about?
Yeah.
So that was very weird that they they both got the best supporting actor nomination. That's kind of puzzling. Anyways, I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I mean, for what ultimately ends up being, you know, I think not necessarily the most radical movie. No. It is interesting that it was met with so much resistance and that it was so hard to get it done. Like that, the very first quote that I forget who it was that said it, but, you know, about like when you put together, you know, this like director who had just made a $1 billion movie and A-list actors and everything else, and you put all that on the table, it should have been an obvious slam dunk that it was going to get made.
And it did. I think like it made a bunch of money. It was, was critically acclaimed. Like, I mean, what I will say about it is I think the biggest criticism you can levy towards it is that it's taking a deeply anti-capitalist, anti-bourgeois story and placing it in the context of arguably the most bourgeois type of movie, which is the biopic, the period biopic. And that is the sort of fairest criticism I've seen sort of levied at it. What I would say is it does not surprise me maybe that it had so much trouble getting made, because ultimately it is quite clear on the fact that Hampton and the Panthers were Marxist-Leninists, and also that they were the good guys and that the cops were the bad guys. And that's, you know, you could say that the execution of the movie isn't necessarily all that radical, but on paper, that's about as radical as Hollywood gets. Without having to shroud everything in, you know, either fiction, like, you know, if you tried to tell this story in a dystopian future, you might be able to get away with it more easily. Mm-hmm. Or you know, if you take out all the very obviously Marxist, not even Marxist coded language, but just Marxist language, like the only change they really made to any of his speeches is they would sometimes, he does use the word proletariat and proletarian a couple of times, but they would sometimes substitute that for people. Which isn't even necessarily something that I have a problem with, because it's just more. I honestly think that the strength of this movie is that it was made for an audience that didn't know anything about it, and it. I think with that in mind, it's incredibly didactic.
Yeah. I mean, I think so too, and I ultimately think it's a great film that did its source material justice. And probably, you know, reached more people with, I think, a fairly succinct fuck the police message than, you know, than it would have if it had been the movie I wanted it to be.
Yeah.
Right. And the movie
that's
I wanted it to be.
Too, yeah.
Yeah. Right. Which, like, you know, not as many people would have watched the movie I wanted it to be, which would have been, you know, more clear on the Panthers' politics, like more explicit about their links with other revolutionary groups, more explicit about the depth of Fred Hampton's like theoretical understanding and the shit that they were teaching, like more of that. You know, I would have made it like that. I would have made it more about like, this is what we need. This is what they needed then. It's what we need now. We need to do this. And, you know, that probably wouldn't have been as interesting of a film. So, you know, like, I guess that's why they don't hire Marxist academics to, you know, edit scripts before they go out, right? Because I've been like, okay, no, needs more revolution. You know, can we talk about the dictatorship of the proletariat here, please? You know, where's the means of production in this?
Yeah.
But ultimately I like it. I struggle on whether I'm giving it a 3.5 or a 4 stars. I think ultimately you've talked me back up to 4.
That's a totally fair score to give this. I think so.
On
Letterboxd, when I reviewed it after watching it the first time, I gave it a 4.5 out of 5, but I'll readily admit that I would be more inclined to give it 4, but I gave it that extra half. Basically because I was like, well, for the audience that this is for, I'll give it an extra half star just under the guise of like, if you knew nothing about this and you went in and you watched it, you would come out with a shockingly good handle on a lot of different things, like how evil the FBI is, what they do, how, like, the multiplicity of their evil, what the Panthers was about, what Hampton was about, and why it all came crumbling down. And and so I gave it, I think 4 is a totally fair score to
give. I sit on 4 because of that one scene that I really disliked.
As I've heard from many people.
The softening of the FBI agent, the opening up of the possibility that, and I think, you know, to come back briefly to that scene, I understand that it could have been there to say the deeper you go, the worse it gets. The deeper you dig into the institutions, the deeper you go into the FBI, the worse they are, the more racist they are. As bad as the front line FBI guy is, the deeper you go, it's worse. Like, I get that, and that's a fair point, and one I would arguably agree with, but it didn't work for me in the film the way it was put there, and it really kind of, it killed one little part of it for me, so I can't go higher than 4, but no, otherwise, very good film. I'm glad we watched it. I'm glad people watched it, and I hope lessons will be taken from it. I hope that,
certainly,
you know, it will inspire the different kind of organizing going forward.
Do you mind if we've gone long here, although there is going to be some things, some dead air that gets cut out. So do you mind if I very quickly read like 5 paragraphs from this National Review article?
This is
the review that was posted in National Review by a guy named Armand White. Oh my God. That is so funny.
That is good. Yeah.
It's called The Facile False Romance of Judas and the Black Messiah. I'm going to skip ahead here to once again, like through kind of some of the stage setting plot stuff and just into the heart of the review here. So he says, but scenes of Hampton's firebrand oratory in brackets, I am a revolutionary, resemble woke corporate advertising and Black History Month public service announcements about the 60s. The idea that blacks are always victims gets us nowhere. So this is going to be some real Mad Lib shit here. Jeez. Because, we've already got woke corporate advertising. Yeah. That's a good one. So identify the Mad Libs where you see them, if you like, those of you listening at home. Shaka King's debut feature, the clever 2013 comedy Newlyweeds, dared show the generation of potheads that the Panthers generation had failed. Okay, that's another good
interesting
one.
Yeah.
But now King capitulates to Black Lives Matter folly and the manipulation of millennial blacks by white radical sympathizers.
What?
King and... I know. You're going to say that probably at least 4 more times. King and Coogler, caught up in the fervor of fashionable anarchy, deny the failure of the hope and change movement. So we've...
Fashionable anarchy? What?
So the Panthers are... So far we have the Panthers resemble woke corporate advertising. And the movie, at least, is retconning, I guess, the Panthers as being manipulated by white radical sympathizers the way millennials are.
Good God.
They're caught up in the fervor of fashionable anarchy, and they deny the failure of the Hope and Change movement, which is Barack Obama. So far, what I'm seeing here is the thing that these things have in common is that is black people.
Yeah, that's the only link so far. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, Judas and the Black Messiah addresses its characters' conflicting motives, but it's judgmental and winds up offering self-delusion to a generation of Afrocentric robots.
Jesus Christ.
To imply that the Black Panther's failed revolution is what's needed today is, in fact, capitulation to the most heinous exploitative politics of the moment. It is shocking that Warner Brothers, a major Hollywood studio, promotes political radicalism as entertainment. Not just incitement to revolution, Judas and the Black Messiah rabble-rounds his, quote, change by suggesting that Fred Hampton was a messiah and Bill O'Neill was Judas. He's paid $300 by the FBI, like 300 pieces of silver. This fucking pisses me off because that's a lie. It says in the closing crawl that the FBI paid him the equivalent of $200,000.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's not that much money.
No.
In fairness, because he was an informant for like 5 years or something. Yeah. But that's more than fucking $300. Like, yeah. Shut the fuck up.
I know.
This would-be spiritual parable is facile false romantic fantasy. King includes a reenactment of the actual O'Neill being interviewed in the monumental 80s documentary Eyes on the Prize by the late Henry Hampton. This breach of filmmaking integrity would be outrageous if millennial audiences even knew that this awesome documentary overview of the civil rights struggle existed. It's been substituted by propaganda worshiping James Baldwin and John Lewis.
Oh, for God's sake.
No doubt King and Coogler meant well, but their misrepresentation of Henry Hampton's historic journalism and the heroic effort behind it is as shameful as Spike Lee's exploitation flicks. Those who don't know their cinematic history are doomed to distort it. Today's race traitors are less likely FBI agents than media professionals. So yeah, I just read this right before we recorded. Oof. And I was like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
It reads like Mad Libs. Cause I can't, I read through the whole thing and I don't know what the thesis is.
It comes back to something you said. I don't think we were even rolling yet, but we were talking about when conservatives are so contradictory that like you don't even know how they can hold the contradictions together in their own position. And that's what that sounds like. Like, I don't know what exactly that guy's mad about, other than he's mad about black people.
And the funniest thing about this is that based on the photo here of Armand White, he appears to be a black guy.
Yeah, I figured. Yeah,
which makes it even better.
Yeah,
it's like, yeah, like,
yeah,
like, I mean, I guess, you know, the National Review is not sending us their best.
No, no, they really aren't. Like that, but yeah, I was going to say that bit about like race traitors was what made me think, oh, okay, I see. So he's positioning himself as like, you know, presumably, I don't know, but I would have to assume that this guy, you know, imagines himself to be, you know, an Obama-esque type guy who believes that black people should pull themselves up by their bootstraps and stop being victims and stop claiming victimhood and stop playing anarchy.
Yeah, like Bill Cosby. He believes
yes,
the same thing.
I mean,
he believes all the things, same things that Bill Cosby.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's rough. That's really rough. Almost makes me want to give the movie another star. Truthfully,
yeah, that's exactly what I mean, right?
Yeah,
yeah. I wanted to share it because I was just like, damn, this doesn't make any sense at all. I don't know.
Yeah, that's
what,
rough.
I don't know what any of this is getting to. So anyways,
it makes me feel better because I know that compared to that, we must make some sense at the very
absolutely
least.
Yeah. No, I would think we are, you know, the propaganda of James Baldwin,
right?
To that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's another long one. I have a feeling that's going to be a theme with a lot of these movies. There's just so much to say. You have to talk about the movie. And that's half of it. And then you also have to give, like, you know, a little bit of context into the history of it, too. And I mean, God, we didn't even get into as much as we could have about the Panthers. Maybe we can do a maybe we can do like a Trial of Chicago 7 episode, yeah, so that we can talk a little bit about Bobby Seale. That movie sucks though.
Yeah.
So,
I know.
You know, I'm not looking forward to it.
I know.
But yeah, this was a fun one. Thanks for listening, guys, and we'll see you next time.